Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm JP Nichols, and this week, we're looking at next-gen banking services and self-driving money with Andy Ratcliffe, co-founder and CEO of Wealthfront. Then, in the second half, I'll be speaking with Jason Barsima from Halo Investing, sharing how their platform is expanding the future of robo-investing through structured notes. Well, Andy, welcome to the show. Wealthfront has been known as one of the world's first robo-advisors, but you don't call yourself a robo-advisor. You say you're in next-gen banking services. What is Wealthfront, and what do you mean by next-gen banking services?
Well, we've tried to take the lessons that we learned from revolutionizing the investment space and apply them to the banking space. So what we do is we help you optimize both your short-term and long-term finances. So on the short-term side, that's with banking services like a high-yield FDIC-insured cash account. And on the long-term side, it's with investment services, a diversified portfolio of low-cost index funds.
Yeah, and you started on the longer side. Maybe take us back to the early days of Wealthfront and why you started it.
Well, I started it to do a social good. It actually happened by accident. I had a long career in venture capital, the last 10 years of which was at a firm that I co-founded called Benchmark Capital. And we have a unique structure at Benchmark where it's an always equal partnership. And the only way that you can make room for new younger partners is the older partners have to step aside. And so when I reached that point, I wanted to give back. I became a trustee at my undergrad alma mater. I started teaching at my grad school alma mater at Stanford. My wife and I started an initiative to fund cancer research in a different way. And one of my responsibilities as a Penn trustee was to sit on the endowment board, which I now chair. The Ivy League endowments are the best managed large pools of capital in the world. And so I saw that a lot of what they do is manual, and that by automating it through software, you could actually democratize access to sophisticated investment management. And then we've taken those techniques of automating everything and applied them to an area that actually is a bigger nerve for people, and that's banking.
Well, and so much of the innovation that we've seen in financial services has been on the payment side, on money movement, on some of the maybe more simple pieces. You started with one of the most complex pieces.
That's because I'm not that intelligent.
If you'd have been smarter, you would have started with something simpler.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the wealth side of the business is full of complexity. It's full of expense. It's full of smart but expensive people. And so, I mean, how did you figure out what you wanted to tackle first in simplifying that whole process?
Well, it was really obvious in that the best managed pools of capital, the Ivy League endowments, all do it very, very similarly. The research from academic institutions is incredibly consistent, which is you can't outperform the market, so you shouldn't try. Therefore, you should just buy index funds that represent different asset classes and rebalance them over time. And computers are much better at doing that than people are. And then you can make them tax efficient through something called tax loss harvesting. And so basically what we did was we automated and we optimized. If we couldn't automate, we wouldn't do it. And the beauty of software is it allows you to optimize. And that's basically what we've done with banking, that there's a treasure trove of financial data available today with your permission from all of your financial accounts that's accessible via application programming interfaces. And using machine and deep learning techniques, we can learn a lot about you and basically put all of your money on autopilot. We can manage your finances for you in a way that's superior to what you could do for yourself. So that means by next year, we're going to be able to allow you to direct deposit your paycheck with us. We'll automatically pay your bills, and then we'll route the remaining money to the most appropriate account, be it a savings account, the equivalent of a savings account. We can't call it a savings account because we're not regulated as a bank, but be it a high-yield cash account or a college savings plan, a 529 plan, or an investment account.
So coming at it from the investment side where you have, what really sets you apart from, you know, say the Chimes of the world, the other that are kind of coming at it from the banking or transactional side of the business?
Sure. Well, I think that Chime has done an absolutely superb job serving the unbanked and people living paycheck to paycheck. They have a very nice, simple user interface. And the primary value added is they give you your paycheck 2 days sooner. And for someone living paycheck to paycheck, that's an enormous benefit. But they don't really add much value beyond that. They're building everything on top of a company called Bancorp. There's very little back-end depth to what they do. It's a pretty user interface. It's very simple. And if they get you your paycheck 2 days sooner, that's great. We're trying to serve the millennial who's actually doing really well in their career and starting to save. You know, there's 90 million millennials. It's the largest generation in our nation's history. And we think at least 20 million of those people have great jobs, are doing very well, they're saving a lot of money. And getting their paycheck 2 days sooner doesn't really solve much problem for them. They want more. So that kind of user typically puts all of their expenses on their credit card so they can get travel points. And they have balances that they've saved on which they want to make money. Chime doesn't pay them any interest. And we pay a very high rate of interest. It's now 1.82%. And that's allowed us to accumulate $8 billion of deposits in our cash account in the first 8 months we've offered this. And to our knowledge, that's the fastest any bank has ever accumulated deposits in the history of banks.
Well, it certainly would be enviable for a lot of the banks that I know and have worked with. And
So we serve a very different customer than Chime, which I think is doing a great job.
Yeah. And you mentioned millennials, but and your customer base skews a little lower, but you really have customers across all of the generations and all the ages.
No. 90% of our clients are under 40.
90%. So was that something that was a target, or was that surprising for you?
No, that was intentional.
Yeah.
So the idea being that when we thought about what our strengths and weaknesses were, we were trying to build a service that was delivered exclusively through software, where we didn't want to have any people. We have customer support to help you with your problems, but we don't want to have advisors. And that appeals specifically to people under 40 because, as they tell us, we pay you not to talk to us. Having to call people or meet with people is really culturally offensive to people who are under 40.
Yet the argument for so many of the traditional players are, hey, we have a lot of good technology, but we have people too. And some of your competitors are, even those that started with a more of a technology base have been adding people.
I know, but they haven't been growing nearly as quickly as we have.
So this fits into your philosophy of what you said earlier, self-driving money. What does that vision look like over the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, we literally think we can put your finances on autopilot and in a way that's superior to what you would have done with your money. Our average client links up 6.25 financial accounts to our service. So that might be their bank account, their brokerage account, their house, their mortgage. If they have a cryptocurrency account, it might be that. And so we take all of this data in, and we understand where they're spending their money, where they're keeping their money. As an example, many of them keep way too much money in cash, and they're losing out on what they could be worth over time. And so just providing them with the advice as to how they should allocate their savings can make an enormous impact on their lifestyle and ultimately their retirement. And then we'll actually even allow them to push a button and have it all just done for them, where all of their finances are optimized without them having to ever do anything.
And how has the...
Imagine if you have a mortgage on your home and it just automatically gets refinanced whenever rates drop and you get those savings without ever having to do anything. That's the vision of self-driving money.
Now, would that be a service that you're providing directly or something you're partnering with another provider for, say, well, on the refinance?
In the near term, we might partner with a bank to provide the loans, but ultimately we'll provide the loans. But all of that will be seamless to the end user. For example, one of the services we offer is called a portfolio line of credit. When you open an investment account with us of at least $25,000, you're automatically enrolled into this service such that with the click of one button, you can borrow up to 30% of your account value and the funds will hit your account the next day and you'll pay a much lower interest rate than you pay for a home equity line of credit. We have partnered with a company called RBC, a large bank based in Canada, to lend us the money that we in turn lend to our clients. But our clients never see that. They just see something that's unbelievably fast, unbelievably easy, and unbelievably inexpensive.
So this is a theme that we've been talking about on the show for quite a while, the kind of rebundling of financial services. 10, 12 years ago, the start of the fintech revolution was really about unbundling, taking all of these individual services and optimizing them with specialist players. But we're now beginning to see players like you and others who are beginning to rebundle and put things together. So you think you can do for traditional banking services what you've already done for investing?
Absolutely. And by the way, this is not a new concept. I think there are a number of companies that all aspire to be your financial hub.
Right.
The one place you go for all of your financial services. The market tends to change every 20 years. I don't know why it's 20 years, but it seems to be every 20 years. 40 years ago, Merrill Lynch changed the world with something called a cash management account.
Right.
It was the first time that you could have your banking and brokerage account in one. They basically allowed you to write checks on top of a money market account. This was a radical idea because prior to the introduction of the CMA, no one wanted to attempt it because of the Glass-Steagall Act, which forbid banks and investment firms from combining. But Merrill Lynch figured out a way around that rule, and that's what catapulted them into the lead among the traditional wirehouse brokerage firm and allowed them to build a very, very big business. 20 years ago, approximately, Charles Schwab introduced the first free ATM on top of what was a brokerage account. Most people don't realize it, but today Schwab is a bank. They're not a brokerage firm. Two-thirds of their revenues come from banking services, and it allowed them to really pull away from people like E-Trade and everyone else. Now, 20 years later, again, there are a bunch of us who are trying to become that financial hub. And I think that the internet and, more importantly, software, but specifically APIs and AI, enable us to deliver services at radically lower costs and radically more conveniently.
Well, and in the last 5 or 10 years, even in the middle of that cycle, Schwab's and the Merrill Lynch's and others have had to respond to upstarts like Wealthfront to be able to lower their fees and to provide more digital access. How do you see the traditional providers responding to self-driving money the way you see it going forward?
Well, you know, it's funny. If you look at the investment world as a proxy, typically at first, they deny that it's valuable.
Right.
Then
it's the grief cycle. Right. Right.
Then they say it's really not that good. Then they adopt it and then they lose. So typically what they do is, because they can't attract great engineering talent, they build a product that is far, far less featured. And they usually do it to try to keep people from leaving as opposed to try to earn new customers. So for example, in Schwab's case, they've attracted a lot of assets to their service, but only $3 or $4 billion from new clients. And that's with an annual advertising budget of $100 million. In contrast, we've attracted almost $22 billion. And that's all from new clients. So they will lead you to believe that they're doing well, but all they're doing is shifting the deck chairs on the Titanic. They're just moving money around from one account to another. They're not attracting new people with what's an I would call a defensive attempt. We're now seeing that in banking. So by the way, every brokerage firm, I think, now has a robo-advisor, but none of them are doing terribly well. We're now seeing it in banking where they all want to offer something, but they're not very good at software. Witness JP Morgan introduced a personal finance app called Finn, and then a year after introducing it, they've now written it off because it was so bad.
Right, and there may be other reasons behind that closure. In your grief cycle, you forgot my favorite part of it, the part where they say, oh, well, I guess that's cool, but that's not our customer. Right, our customer wants something else over here, and so that puts off the adoption of the newer technology even longer because they're convinced that their customer values something else.
Well, that's the innovator's dilemma.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have tended to benchmark yourself as you think about your company and your advantage and the future. You benchmark yourself more to the Netflixes of the world rather than the financial services. Talk a little bit more about your kind of orientation around software and engineering and how that approach is different at Wealthfront.
Well, you know, it's funny. When people talk about fintech, at least the consumer-facing companies are really big on fin and really low on tech.
Right.
They're marketing companies that build a thin veneer on top of other companies. I think Chime is a fantastic example. They solve a big problem, but they're primarily marketing companies. In contrast, over 50% of our employees are engineers. We win through delight. We win through organic growth as opposed to advertising. If we build great products, then we think that our clients will tell their friends about it. If you look at every great technology company, they built themselves through organic growth. Now, once they got to critical mass, they might have started to advertise, but you didn't see Google or Facebook or Netflix ads in the early days. They spread because they delighted their customer. The other issue with fintech or finance is that I only know of one financial services company that puts its customers' interests ahead of its own, and that's Vanguard, and they're a not-for-profit. So we really embrace the idea of putting customers' interests first. It's actually one of our four company values, and that leads to a very, very different style and outcome. So we avoid hiring people from the financial industry. The only people that we hire are the ones that we have to for regulatory reasons, but we think they think wrong and we don't want them.
Well, given that approach and what you just mentioned, regulatory reasons, how have you navigated the regulatory schemes? I mean, that's very complex in your part of the business.
You know, it really isn't. We were really fortunate about a year ago to hire a chief compliance officer and general counsel who had been the chief compliance officer for JP Morgan's broker dealer. And he had had a short stint in the technology business, so he had seen both sides. In addition to working at JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, he had two stints at the SEC. So he's on a first name basis with everyone over there. And what he does is very simple and straightforward. Before we ship products, he calls people up at the SEC and at FINRA, our two regulators, and he meets with them to show them what we're going to do. And when you do that, you build credibility and you get feedback on what you can and can't do. as opposed to shipping things quickly and breaking things. That doesn't work in the financial world. And I think Robinhood really learned a lesson from that.
Well, and I think even a lot of the traditional players can learn from that too. We spend a lot of time with banks and hear this disconnect that they kind of wait to hear from their examiners around, gee, we don't know if this thing is going to be okay. And so you're talking about taking a much more proactive approach.
Absolutely. And we did that with our cash account so that there were no issues. You know, we didn't call it a checking or a savings account. We didn't misrepresent what we do. If you look at our advertisements, we have to have a disclosure in every one of our ads. And the first line in our disclosure is, we are not a bank. And our competitors who want to make people feel like they're a bank don't say things like that, and that gets them into regulatory trouble.
Hmm. So let's go back to the self-driving money concept and vision that you have and the focus that you have on really maximizing technology and minimizing the people. Again, a lot of your competitors are taking the other path, as you point out, and many of them are not growing at the rate you are. But what do you hear directly from your customers? How do they like this? This still seems so foreign to so many traditional players that...
It does because they don't serve millennials. You know, I think the banking industry has been built for baby boomers. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, I'm a baby boomer, but we're not building a service for me. And people my age, I'm 61, and people my age like talking to someone. That's how I was conditioned.
Do you operate that way, though? Because I'm just a few years younger than you, and I definitely, in terms of financial services, I act a lot more like a millennial, and that's why I initially said...
I do like talking to people. I have to admit it.
Yeah.
And my kids are 25 and 28, and they will go to unbelievable lengths not to have to talk to someone.
Right, right. Same with the millennials in my life.
We have an engineer in our company who got a $1,000 refund from some service, and he won't cash it because he has to go to a bank. Now, that's ridiculous. But I tell the story for effect to show how different a culture it is. And the people who run these banks are older, and they don't understand this. And they think, well, that when they get older, they'll change their ways. I don't believe that's the case. I think it's a cultural, issue that's just not going to change.
It's really interesting because I also happen to think that boomers and aging adults have a lot of unmet needs too. And that's why I initially asserted, you know, even though 90% of your customers are millennials, I hear about you from people in my peer group, right, that enjoy using that. So I think the appeal is even broader than that.
Every once in a while, we catch a dolphin in our tuna nets. That's not what we're intending to do. We're trying to build something that's really optimized for people under 40. And the challenge that we face is, you know, first of all, you know that someone's older when they call our customer support line.
That's the first clue.
That's the first clue. And then when they ask to have us explain why they should use our service, we immediately know that they're older because they don't want to just read about it.
Please tell me no one says, okay, boomer.
Well, actually, that meme is very big in our company. And then they want to, but they really love the price, but they want the price plus the support and the personal interaction. And that's the worst place to be in business. You can't be a hybrid. Hybrids, I know from many years of success in venture capital that that's the dumbest place you can be. And it amazes me that people are taking that approach with financial services.
I hear a lot about, well, when something goes wrong, you know, that's when they want a person to go to. And it occurs to me that we should spend a whole lot more time making sure nothing goes wrong then.
That's our philosophy. And things seldom go wrong.
Yeah. Well, talk maybe just a little bit before we have to head to break about your client acquisition strategy. You're not you're not advertising, and this is really one of the tough things. So even having a great product, it's hard to find new customers. How are you going about that?
By delighting our customers.
And so how
it's
does
really
that?
It's as simple as that. You know, I often reference Netflix because I'm such a huge fan of Reed Hastings, their CEO. I had the good fortune of sitting on the board of his previous company. And one of the things that I learned from Reed is delight is the greatest form of virality. And that if you delight your customers, they tell everyone they know. And that's how you build a really strong business, not through advertising, because that the spread that you make from the cost of advertising gets arbitraged away. It's a nice way to accelerate your business, but it should not be the foundation of your business.
Well, how do you measure that delight, and how do you measure that then translating into new customers?
Well, in two ways. Our clients are in the wealth accumulation phase of their careers, not the wealth preservation phase of their careers. So we measure delight by the rate at which they add on to their accounts, which makes for a phenomenal business because our average client adds about 40 to 50% to their client, to their account every year. And we also measure it through our referral system that's built into our service to see how many people they're inviting.
And how are those metrics stacking up for you?
Well, about a third of our clients come from our invitation system. Another third probably come from physical referrals. Another 10% or so probably come from PR and doing things like this. And then probably maybe 10 or 15% comes from advertising.
Well, that's great. Well, Andy, before we head to break, I'll give you the last word here. And anything else that, as you think about where we go from here, not only Wealthfront, but this whole fintech and financial services, you said something recently that we say a lot on the show, right? The banking changes in the next 10 years are more than the last 200 years. Where do we go from here?
I don't think people can imagine where we go from here because they're used to the same thing we implemented on different platforms. If you think about it, the last innovation in banking was the ATM. And that enabled people to do self-service. In other words, they could do banking transactions for themselves. You didn't need to use a teller. Now, over the years, the ATM machine has gotten better and better. They have better graphics. They have touch screens. They store data on your use of the machine, so there are fewer keystrokes. But they haven't really added any new services. And mobile apps are really just ATMs in your pocket. The things that you can do via your mobile app is exactly the same thing you can do on the ATM machine. Basically, they're just making it easier and easier for you to do it yourself. But most people don't want to do banking themselves. Most people would rather have it done for them. And I think the technology is now becoming available to make that crazy world a reality where you don't have to worry about your finances. They actually can be done for you and done better than you would do yourself, so you can enjoy that time in much better ways.
Well, Andy Ratcliffe, thanks for joining us today on Breaking Banks. Glad to have you. We'll be right back with more Breaking Banks right after this.
Let me tell you about one of our new sponsors for Breaking Banks. I love these guys, Bowl and Branch Sheets. And I love them because, you know, I didn't think of flannel sheets as luxury. I didn't think of them as modern. But what these guys have done with these things is they're incredibly comfortable. In fact, they're rated as the softest and most comfortable sheets in the world and the only bedding loved by three U.S. presidents. For a limited time, you can get their luxury flannel bedding to keep you cool, sleepers warm, and because they breathe, keep the warm sleepers cool. Shipping is always free. You can try them out for 30 nights risk-free, and right now, you get $50 off your first set of sheets at bowlandbranch.com with promo code BANKS. You can get $50 off bowlandbranch.com, promo code BANKS. So you spell that B-O-L-L and branch, .com. Don't forget to use the Banks code to promo code to get you $50 off.
One of the downsides of the hectic life, doing so much in media and conferences and speaking, time on planes and family and kids and the amount of stress, you know, part of aging, unfortunately, comes with male pattern baldness. Do you know that 2 out of 3 guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness? Now, I noticed as I was passing 40, started to get a little thinner up there. And, you know, through one of our sponsors, Keeps, KEEPS.com, I've learned that actually, one, you don't have to go broke. And second, it actually is much better to be preventative in what you're doing. And so I had always thought, you know, you wait until it's all gone, then you have to go about doing something more severe. But actually with Keeps, it is inexpensive to really be able to start getting ahead of male pattern baldness. They're up to a 90% effective rate at reducing and stopping further hair loss. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. So act fast. Many men even experience hair regrowth with the Keeps treatment. Keeps has revolutionized the way men are treated for hair loss. Thanks to Keeps, you no longer have to go to the doctor's office. None of us have time for that. No one wants to sit in the waiting room. Now you can visit a doctor online and get your hair loss medication delivered to your home. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy checkout lines, no juggling children while trying to get your hair loss prevention done. That's why Keeps gets more 5-star reviews than any of its competitors. And nearly 100,000 men trust Keeps for their hair loss prevention medication. Medication and treatment start at just $10 a month. Plus, for a limited time, you get your first month free. How do you get this deal? Well, go to Keeps, KEEPS.com/fintech. to receive this special offer of your first month free. That's keeps.com/fintech. You got to check it out, keeps.com.
At Breaking Banks, we're very happy to have Dollar Shave Club as a sponsor of our program, of our podcast. And I've been a member of them for years. You might remember a few years ago, they went very viral. And of course, you probably know they have, world-class products like the Executive Razor, Shea Butter, Prep Scrub, and so forth. But if you go to their website, you can actually take this quiz and they will take you through all of your needs for grooming. They have everything you need: shower, shave, styling your hair, brushing your teeth, everything. And you can configure that to your needs, and they can keep you automatically stocked up on the products you use. You get what you want whenever you need it, whether that's once a month or just a few times a year. So right now, you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's products to the test. Their Ultimate Shaver Starter Set has basically everything you need for an amazing shave: the Executive Razor, Shave Butter, Prep Scrub, and Post Shave Dew. The best part is you can try it, because you're a Breaking Bank listener, for just $5. After that, the restock box ships regular size products at regular prices. And you get the ultimate starter set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/fintech. That's dollarshaveclub.com/fintech.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is JP Nichols, and I'm here now with Jason Barsema. Jason is co-founder and president of Halo Investing. Jason, talk a little bit about what you're doing, because you're really focused on, in the first half, we talked with Andy Ratcliffe from Wealthfront, who's more direct-to-consumer and kind of a robo-advisor turned next-gen financial services. You're really servicing the financial advisors in what you do. So tell us about Halo Investing.
Yeah. Hi, JP, and thank you for having me on. Halo Investing is a financial technology company that's centered around the $3 trillion market called structured notes. So I always like to joke that structured notes are kind of the biggest market no one's ever heard of. And what we do is that we connect the issuers of these structured notes to advisors across 5 continents making the product that once was complex a lot more simple and safer and easier to understand, all delivered through technology.
Well, let's start at kind of square one. What is a structured note, and in high level terms, and then talk about why they're important in an investor's portfolio?
It's a great question. And so to kind of back up, before I founded Halo, I spent my career at Credit Suisse managing portfolios for ultra high net worth individuals and institutions. And structured notes were one of the most important parts of my portfolios. And in some, I thought they were one of the most elegant products I've ever worked with, but one of the most inefficient in practice, which is why I started the company. And from a high level standpoint, a structured note is really just a candy wrapper. And inside that candy wrapper is a bond and an option. And what it's intended to do is to give investors a level of investment downside protection against market declines. And it also has the ability to provide some income or yield, which is important in an environment where interest rates are negative, at least across 30% of the bonds around the world. And so with structured products, there's really four components. And if you can understand these four components or variables, you can understand any structured note out there. And the first variable is the maturity date. And so like a bond, a structured note's got a maturity date. That maturity date can be anywhere from 6 months out to 10 years. The advisor picks it. The second variable is the underlying asset. So what is the performance of the structured note linked to? And that can be an ETF like SPY. It can be an index like the IFA. It could be gold. It could be, you know, the stock of Apple, really whatever you like. And that's called the underlying. The third variable is the payoff. Obviously, what do you get? And structured notes either give you a percentage of the upside of the underlying, or it provides a fixed return that's paid out kind of like a bond, like a quarterly coupon, which is why I say they can derive income in the portfolio. And then finally, the fourth variable is the reason why we all buy it, which is it provides a level of investment protection against the decline of the underlying. And so think of it as kind of a little bit of a comfort of a cushion around your investment or insurance around your investment. Structured notes can play very important roles in the portfolios. And while you can use them in really three different ways, the primary way is as kind of a core investment replacement. For example, with my own family's money, which I help oversee, is that I will sell my long SPY exposure. So I am passive in my U.S. large cap core exposure. And I will replace that SPY exposure with a structured note that gives me a percentage of the upside of the SPY with a level of downside protection. So kind of as a direct example, I recently bought a note when volatility picked up a few weeks ago, where it was a five-year note linked to the S&P 500. It gave me about 120% of the price appreciation of the S&P 500. So I get 1.2 times the upside of the S&P on a price appreciation basis. And it gave me hard protection on the downside of 25%. And so what that means is that at maturity, if the S&P was down 0 to 25, I'm down nothing. The S&P is down 30, I'm only down 5, which is why these tools can be so important within portfolios.
Right. And we talked with Andy in the first half about kind of democratizing this. And so that's a theme for you too, right? These are thanks for that description. It's you make it sound fairly straightforward, but it's a somewhat complex derivative and was sold in a pretty complex way as I understand it. So maybe, you know, give us a description at a high level. And not too many of us are, you know, sitting on trading desks here listening to the show, but talk about how these products were put together and sold and made available to investors in the past, and what you're trying to do to change that.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important question. I always joke that the complex of today is the vanilla of tomorrow, right? When options first came out in the late 70s, you know, a put option was mind-blowing, right? And now that's considered vanilla. And that's ultimately where we believe the structured note market is going, and technology plays an important role because
I think of it kind of like the car options, right? With the craziest options on your S-Class Mercedes today will be standard equipment on your Honda 5 years from now, right?
Exactly. And I always say the exact same thing. And you use one of my metaphors there, which I think is an important question that you asked, where when you looked at structured products prior to Halo, and again, this is a $3 trillion market globally, and $1 trillion of structured notes get issued every single year. So it's a big market. It's just a big market that no one's ever heard of because 99% of the world has never had access to it. And so, you know, in the United States in particular, you know, structured products were born in Europe in the 70s, but they really became more popular in the United States in the early 2000s. But it's a high net worth product and an ultra high net worth product, only sold through private banks. And if you believe in modern portfolio theory and some of the theories that even Wealthfront, you know, prescribes to, is that the people who need downside investment protection the most are not the ultra high net worth. It's the retail and the mass affluent, right? Because we can't afford to lose our money. And so when you look at how these things were put together, structured notes are issued by a bank, such as a Citigroup or a Morgan Stanley or a Wells Fargo. So it's an obligation of the bank who issues it. Then you have a bunch of people on the desk, as you alluded to, are manually constructing these things and manually distributing these things, and the financial advisor are manually buying these things. And I think of it as very much of how cars were assembled prior to Henry Ford's assembly line, right? A lot of time, a lot of cost, a lot of humans, thus high sticker prices, thus only the wealthiest Americans could buy a car. Henry Ford comes in with his assembly line, and all of a sudden, every American can drive a Ford, right? And Halo is really Henry Ford's assembly line for structured products, where we disrupt the manufacturing process by inserting technology, removing ultimately 60% of the cost for a bank to issue these products. As a result, they can issue at much lower minimum investment sizes. We take the investment sizes now down to $1,000. And we pass a lot of those savings that we extract from the manufacturing process, and we pass them on to the customer in regards to better investment terms. And so we just make the product a lot more scalable to manufacture, a lot more scalable to distribute. And ultimately, with technology, you can remove a lot of the complex features of a structured note. So you strip it down to something that's simple and easy to understand, and most importantly, easy to fit in a portfolio.
So are you focused more on the sell side, the issuers and manufacturers of these securities, or more on the buy side, the RIAs and the investment managers who are then selling these structured products to their end customers?
So Halo is kind of like Uber, right? Where all my drivers are my issuers. So Halo works with 27 banks around the world who issue these products. Everybody from the American banks to the Canadian banks to the Swiss, the French, the Germans, you name it. And we go through a deep level of due diligence on who we allow to manufacture these products on a platform. One of the cool initiatives, as a side note for Halo going into 2020, is bringing in non-bank issuers into the platform. So you'll be able to buy a structured note, perhaps from a municipality or even Apple itself, which is very innovative and revolutionary on the structured note side. And so those are my drivers. And then the riders are financial advisors around five continents, right? And so we work with RIAs, broker dealers, and banks on virtually every corner of the world. But to answer your question is I'm buy side first, right? I'm from the buy side. Halo is built for the buy side. And what that means is we really put the customer needs, you know, first, as your previous guest, Andy Ratcliffe, was talking about, you know, building an elegant solution and focusing really on the customer as one of his four core values. Halo's in the same camp, right? Structured products have been owned and monopolized by the big banks for too long. You know, these banks that have come into our platform have really seen the light. So kudos to them about the benefit and the impact that they can have by going out and distributing these products to all investors, not just the privy few. And so while we do cater to both, we're certainly focused on the buy side.
Did you have any regulatory hurdles to go through, particularly as you made this more available at $1,000 bites rather than, you know, large ultra high net worth investors?
So not as much regulatory hurdles because structured notes are counted as or considered as a corporate bond. They have a CUSIP attached to them, and you can hold them directly in your brokerage account just like you would buy any other bond. But, you know, we've been very proactive in reaching out to FINRA and the SEC, you know, about making sure what we're doing and how we're presenting it is the right way of going about it. And that's one of our, you know, that's something that we take great pride in, is being able to, you know, ultimately ensure that we protect our customers. I always say that Halo is kind of like the government, right? Where I want to give power to the people and I want to give power to the advisors to be able to create what they want and buy what they want and do it in a transparent and competitive and fee efficient manner, which was certainly not the case in structured products. But most importantly is as the government, I also have to protect the people. And so we've built a very sophisticated and deep level of portfolio and product analytics. So advisors know not only how these things work, but, you know, what's the risk that they're taking? How does it impact the overall portfolio? How can they benefit the portfolio? And I think doing that in an unbiased and transparent way is really one of our core value propositions, because Halo is not capitalized by the banks. A lot of the banks came to invest in Halo and we politely declined them because I don't want to be at the mercy of any of the issuers, right? We want to be independent agnostic. And I think our customers have really appreciated that on a number of different levels.
So your end user investors, are they more in the preservation of wealth stage? Andy Ratcliffe from Wealthfront talked about his 90% of his customers are under 45 and they're accumulating. They're rapidly adding to their portfolio. What are you seeing about kind of the demographics of your end user customers?
That's a great question. I think, you know, ultimately our customer is the financial advisor, and the age of those financial advisors, you know, is across the spectrum from 25 to 65 years old. And I think the reason why they like structured products, and again, is this is one of the most challenging investment markets I've ever seen, where you have stock markets at all-time highs and bond yields at all-time lows. And most of these advisors, especially the independent advisors, they have access to stocks, they have access to bonds, and they have access to nothing in between. And as we saw in 2008, fully diversified portfolios did not play a lot of defense against market declines because correlations go to one, right? Everyone was throwing the baby out with the bathwater. When you look at kind of the surface of structured products of investment protection and being able to provide a lot of income, you would think, you know, logically that the boomer population would be our target market. Mm-hmm. And certainly that is a very important part of the end customer, you know, the folks like you and me who actually have structured products in our portfolio. But what we've actually found is one of the most risk-averse demographics is the millennial. And we see a huge demand from the end customer perspective. And I don't think it's just because of the technology. It's because, you know, the millennial has lived through the tech wreck in the late 90s, maybe through high school, right? And they're learning about investment markets in high school, and then they live through the tech wreck, and then they're in college, and you go through the financial crisis, and you're trying to get a job out of the financial crisis. You know, they've been scarred through two pretty large crises over the last 10 years or last 20 years or so. And I think that that's a reason why they might be a little bit more risk averse. And so, you know, the short answer is we cater to both, you know, the millennial and the boomer. But I was personally surprised when we started the company, what a great reception we received from the millennial customer. I thought it was going to be predominantly the boomers.
Mm. And I don't want to get into, you know, market forecasting here on the show, but it is interesting. I mean, it is the sentiment of the market that does drive those things. I remember the rise of structured product after the global financial crisis. And now there's, you know, these veins of uncertainty running through, but most of them haven't really come to fruition yet. Even the inverted yield curve has kind of righted itself. And when you think about the future of the market, does a part of you actually wish that it gets a little bit more volatile and scary, or is a bull market still okay for what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, the benefit of structured products is they can be whatever you want them to be. For example, if you're bullish on the market, you can buy structured products that have no downside protection. So, you know, you participate one for one on the down, just as you would be if you own the underlying, excluding dividends. That is an opportunity cost with structured products, as you do not get a dividend. But in return for having no protection, you can get some really nice enhanced upside. So maybe, as I was telling you about the product that I bought for my family, where I was getting 120% upside with some protection, if I had no protection, I would probably get 160% of the upside of the S&P. So they can be built for bull markets, for bear markets, and for sideways markets. That's kind of the beauty of structured products. And Halo is really built around trade idea and content generation as well. It's not just a marketplace to buy product. It's really about creating unique and relevant ideas for the advisor. But to specifically answer your question, I think of it as insurance in my own portfolio. So my family's portfolio, we're 20 to 25% structured products, and we've been that way for 15 years, well before I started Halo 5 years ago. And for me, it's insurance, right? Once you're wealthy, you never want to go back. And, you know, whether you have $100 or you have $100 million, it's someone's money. And would you ever own a home without home insurance or drive a car without car insurance? Sure, the probability of you getting in a wreck is probably low, but I'm still not going to take that risk. And so why do we take that risk, right? We insure our cars, our homes, even our dogs, but we don't insure our portfolios. And I think that that's really the trend that you're seeing in wealth management is, you know, boomers are starting to worry about outliving their portfolios, and they should be worried. Mm-hmm. Millennials are worried about building that savings to buy their house or put their kids through college or have discretionary spending. You need that level of protection because you can't afford the loss. Right. And ultimately, I think that that protection keeps people in the market. You know, the one thing about being, whether it's a robo or any other type of long portfolio is, sure, you can have dynamic rebalancing strategies that might perform well under certain market conditions and certain indicators tell you to go more bonds than cash. But fear is hard to protect against, right? Mm. And when people get scared, they sell. And usually when they're scared, it's the market's going down and that's the worst time to sell. You should be buying. But it's hard to tell people not to hit that sell button. And that's maybe one thing that I do differentiate on the future of wealth management is there. It is important to have a financial advisor sometimes, you know, with involved within a portfolio, because if anything, they're a psychologist. Right. And they tell people it's going to be okay. And I think that that's also what structured products do with that level of protection. You don't have to be as worried about those market declines.
Mm. So do you see the future still very much involving human beings as brokers, financial advisors?
I think it depends on what your goals are. When you look at portfolio management in general, I think the days of stock pickers are over, right? I think that where humans really come in, and I used to teach this a lot at Credit Suisse to the incoming financial advisors, it's about providing value to someone's portfolio. And value is in, you know, hey, JP, let's make sure that we have 20% to U.S. equity versus 25%. That's not where you find value in an advisor. You find value in the advisor of the planning aspect, right, from retirement planning, estate planning, and life planning. And yes, technology can do some of that, but I still think it's important to have you know, that human intervention, again, maybe that psychologist involved. Not for everybody, right? I do agree with Andy on the millennial side. Certainly they prefer technology more than maybe, or appreciate technology more than the boomer does. But I do see advisors as, you know, as important parts of the portfolio in the long run.
Well, and even regardless of how you feel about that, I still find it interesting that you're still leveraging technology, not only in your platform, but even within the product. And I think the argument for, hey, I want a human being as a psychologist to help me from making rash decisions during, you know, times of volatility, well, actually, wouldn't a piece of technology be even better, right? Because it, by definition, has no emotions at all. And so that's a part of what you're doing in the product. Well, let's talk, before we have to close today, I want to learn a little bit more about Halo and how you're growing the business. You talked about sitting kind of in the middle between the sell side and the buy side. As you look forward to the next the 5 years or so for Halo, what are the things that are really going to be important to continue to drive growth in the business?
Yeah, and we're really centered around three opportunities to drive our growth. And, you know, we've been blessed enough to be, you know, one of the fastest growing companies in capital markets. And that's been very exciting for us. But now it's about taking it to the next level. And one of those is, you know, about product diversification. So structured products are just one way to get investment protection in your portfolio. But you can also do that through annuities and insurance. And those markets, as we all know, suffer from the same, if not worse, problems than structured notes did, which is a lack of transparency, really high fees, you know, barriers to buy the product because it's very manual and time intensive. Our technology can solve those same problems just as we did for structured notes. So really creating a protective investing marketplace, not just a structured note marketplace. And so that's bucket number one. Bucket number two is our international expansion. So about, you know, 60% or so of our revenues does come from overseas. You know, the United States issues $62 billion a year in structured products. The rest of the world issues $950 billion. And so our international operations and growth has been extraordinary, and we've been taking a lot of things that we've learned internationally and bringing them back home to America, and improving upon what they've done overseas. And so our international growth will continue to be a big part of our overall growth as a company. And then the third and probably the most exciting is the direct-to-consumer, right? And so, you know, 48% of America prefer to manage their own money and 52% prefer an advisor. And as you accurately said, JP, we're technology in the product and in the service and the offering. And so we're not here to tell anybody that you have to work with an advisor. And moreover, I think that the people who manage their own money probably need protection the most. And so we're here to provide an unbiased marketplace, not just by the size of your wallet, but how you prefer to manage your money. And I think that that's really exciting, because no company in the history of structured products over the last, you know, 45 years of the product being around has ever gone direct to consumer. And I think that's the ultimate, you know, the ultimate game of democratizing the product and the ultimate mandate that we have, which is investment democratization.
So how did this whole thing get started? How'd you decide to solve this particular problem?
It was funny. It was in July of 2014, specifically, of a brother of one of my clients who unfortunately did not meet the minimums of Credit Suisse, but I wanted to be able to help him. And his advisor was at an independent advisory network. And he had the line in the sand of he wanted to be worth, you know, no less than X. And X came in March of 2009, and his advisor blew out of the market. And so now fast forward to the summer of 2014, and he's sitting majority in cash wanting to retire. And he had $720,000. I'll never forget it. And he said, gosh, what kind of country is it that I'm afraid that I can't retire and live off of $720,000? Because I'm mostly cash, bonds yield nothing, stocks were at all-time highs at the time. And he didn't have anything in between. And I wish I could have gave him structured products, but I couldn't, because it wasn't available to the everyday investor. And $720,000, last time I checked, is a lot of money. And so, you know, that was the genesis of Halo, is more from a social perspective of people need this product. And I'm not here to disrupt Wall Street or say, oh gosh, you know, Halo's coming for Wall Street. No, I'm Uber. I need Wall Street, right? But at the end of the day, everyone should have a level playing field and equal access to product. And so ours was really about the social aspect of it. And then our number one core value proposition when we started the company was impact before profits, creating a positive impact before we worried about profits. And if you do that, profits ultimately come, right? And so it was really about us is making sure that the people who need downside investment protection the most have it. And that was really the genesis. And you pull behind the curtain at Credit Suisse or any of these Wall Street banks as the issuers, they really need a technology to automate the process, because they're not great developers, right? they don't really attract the development or the engineering talent.
Right.
And so, you know, we provided a service that served both buy side and sell side, and ultimately that's the perfect marriage, right?
Great. Well, Jason Barsima from Halo Investing, thanks for joining us. That's all we have time for this week. Thanks to Andy Ratcliffe from Wealthfront for joining us. As always, do join in on the conversation on Twitter. We always appreciate your feedback, questions, and suggestions. You can find us on Twitter at BreakingBanks1, or you can email us at info@provoke.fm. Let us know if you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment. Our sponsors make the show possible and often provide really great content. Or if you just like the show and want to support it in your own way, give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. That really helps new listeners to find the show. And if you still want more, you can download and listen to any of our more than 300 shows, not only from Breaking Banks, but from our shows like Tech on Reg with Dara Tarkowski, the Finovate podcast with Greg Palmer, FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, and more, all at provoke.fm. Well, that's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.